And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Last year, we started out with the great tsunami and then storms, floods, and hurricanes. That became the big story of the year. This year starts out with more weather drama. Will that be the big story, or will something else become the really big story of 2006? I make my predictions, and I tell you why, when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I like to make predictions. It's one of the perks of having my own radio show. So, as the year 2006 begins to develop, it's time for me to go on record about the big story for 2006. So here it is. 2006 is going to be the year of the great American makeover. Let me explain. It's like having an antique colonial table that you inherited that shows its age. The surface is scratched and water-stained. The joints are loose and wobbly. At some time, someone actually replaced one of its original legs with a newer leg, but it's not a perfect match. A time comes when you have to make a decision. Do I decide it's time to chuck it, or should I make the effort to fix it and refinish it and restore its value and beauty? You know that underneath all the dings and mars is a treasure, beautifully crafted and assembled by hand by master craftsmen hundreds of years ago. And you know that once refinished, it will be a priceless piece that with care could endure another 200 years. So you decide to restore it. And that's a lot of work. You know you're going to have to take off the many previous layers of old varnish that have yellowed and through the years, hidden the beauty underneath. Nevertheless, you begin. And yes, it's a messy job. And I think that's about where we are now in America. We're beginning to decide to refurbish this old country. But to do so, we need to take off the layers to restore it to its beauty once again. Last week, a decision was announced by Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior, Chad Calvert, to officially open up 100% of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, to oil company bidding. The administration's decision was announced 1 month after Congress once again, after repeated attempts to ram through drilling in Anwar, rejected drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This decision concerning the National Petroleum Reserve came as a shock to almost everyone. As within the NPRA is the Teshikpuk Lake Special Area, which has been deemed so unique to wildlife, specifically caribou and geese, that even environmental bad guy James Watt set the area aside for protection. But there is a near obsession by the current administration to drill for oil and gas in areas that have been set aside for protection by all previous administrations. We all know what's been involved. I've learned through years of investigative journalism that when anyone pushes this hard for something, there's something more to the story. So last week, when I witnessed this apparent end run to seal the deal with the stroke of a pen by a second-level Interior Department official, I decided to peel back the layers a bit to see what might be revealed. And what one sees very quickly is yet another manifestation of an ever-increasingly obvious system which subverts the usual checks and balances that have been in place for many decades to provide protection for we the people to prevent the emergence of a chief executive with far too reaching power by proclamation. After all, these lands don't belong to him or his friends. They belong to us. We see yet again what begins to feel like a near illegal scheme amongst a tight-knit bunch of friends generally associated with the Bush family, Texas, and oil. As one who has given my life to standing up for the wild creatures and the wonder, when I see the work of thousands of citizens to protect our wild places, such as the Teshekpuk Lake region, being just written off with the stroke of a pen by one of those close insiders, it's getting to be too much. And that's what leads to the focus of today's show. A real democracy is based on trust and truth. If either one is violated, democracies can be stolen. We are approaching a moment in our history when indictments are pending on an ever-increasing list of people in arm's length of the president and his family: Scooter Libby, Jack Abramoff, Kenny Boy Lay, Tom DeLay. And so when I look into a Chad Calvert with the Interior Department, who with the stroke of his pen transfers our national wealth over to friends in the oil industry, as he did acting alone on Wednesday, and I read that he was appointed in 2004 to his position after serving as part of the Bush transition team in 2001 that helped staff the Department of Interior, or that his wife Jennifer, who had worked directly with Abramoff prior to the year 2000, and then quickly helped form a lobbying group following the 2000 election called Washington Strategies with Bill Janelle, who was the campaign manager for Tom DeLay, it begins to feel quite a bit too smarmy. And this same Chad Calvert's wife Jennifer, just by coincidence, is also associated with being the source of a rumor that originated with the Washington Strategy Group, which Matt Drudge then ran with, which accused John Kerry of having an affair with a 20-year-old journalist named Alexander Pollier. It strikes way too close to home to feel this kind of political incest involved in transferring America's public lands into the domain of friends. Who are these people? And why should we let them get away with such a wanton taking that will forever affect a critical ecosystem that all other administrations have deemed inviolate? Who are these people? The takings of our public land and legacy by insiders is, as far as I'm concerned, going way too far to accept any longer as business as usual, even in Washington. Those of us who play within the law to defend nature and life and our future and our great-grandchildren's right to own the legacy of the wild that has made our country so inspiring, it's time to delve deep into the layers until we meet with the raw wood. But I'm not the only one who feels a sense of outrage and urgency and a need to speak out. This past Monday, Vice President Al Gore made an impassioned and historic plea to we the people to begin a process of taking off the layers that obscure and restore the grand legacy of America and refinish the work that began more than 200 years ago, or we may lose forever our America through backroom scribblings and orders. And so today, I bring you in its entirety Vice President Al Gore speaking at Constitution Hall on Martin Luther King Jr. Day from the nation's capital. Al Gore is, whether you agree with his politics or not, taking a stand for you in this American democracy. In that sense, he is becoming our age's Thomas Jefferson. His voice sets the tone for the beginning of the real remaking of a better America, and hopefully the light of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that we all have inherited as our birthrights as Americans. And so now, Vice President Al Gore.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'd like to thank Michael Osterling for that on-the-spot introduction, and I'd like to thank Michael and the other leaders of the Liberty Coalition for the wonderful work that they are doing to try to help Americans bridge many gaps that have sometimes unnecessarily divided us. I want to thank them for co-sponsoring this event. I want to thank Lisa Brown for her friendship to me and for her outstanding leadership of the American Constitution Society. Tipper and I have long admired her work, and it's a pleasure to work with her. To all of the distinguished guests who are here, Senator Dianne Feinstein, others who are present, I don't know to introduce. And I want to commiserate with Congressman Bob Barr, who was connected live when we walked out on the stage, but having had similar occurrences with live video feeds before, I know what can happen and what he must be feeling right now. And I want to thank all of you for coming. I'd like to start by saying that Congressman Bob Barr and I have disagreed many times over the years. But we have joined together today with thousands of our fellow citizens, Democrats and Republicans alike, to express our shared concern that America's Constitution is in grave danger. In spite of our differences over ideology and politics, we are in strong agreement that the American values we hold most dear have been placed at serious risk by the unprecedented claims of the administration to a truly breathtaking expansion of executive power. As we begin this new year, the executive branch of our government has been caught eavesdropping on huge numbers of American citizens and has brazenly declared that it has the unilateral right to continue without regard to the established law enacted by Congress precisely to prevent such abuses. It is imperative that respect for the rule of law be restored in our country. And that is why many of us have come here to Constitution Hall to sound an alarm and call upon our fellow citizens to put aside partisan differences insofar as it is possible to do so, and join with us in demanding that our Constitution be defended and preserved. It is appropriate that we make this appeal on the day our nation has set aside to honor the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who challenged America to breathe new life into our oldest values by extending its promise to all of our people. And on this particular Martin Luther King Day, it is especially important to recall that for the last several years of his life, Dr. King was illegally wiretapped, one of hundreds of thousands of Americans whose private communications were intercepted by the U.S. government during that period. The FBI privately labeled King the, and I quote, the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country, and vowed to, again, I quote, take him off his pedestal. The government even attempted to destroy his marriage and tried to blackmail him into committing suicide. This campaign continued until Dr. King's murder. The discovery that the FBI conducted this long-running and extensive campaign of secret electronic surveillance designed to infiltrate the inner workings of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and to learn the most intimate details of Dr. King's life was instrumental in helping to convince Congress to enact restrictions on wiretapping, and one result was the Foreign Intelligence and Surveillance Act, often called FISA, which was enacted expressly to ensure that foreign intelligence surveillance would be presented to an impartial judge to verify that there was indeed a sufficient cause for the surveillance. It included ample flexibility and an ability for the executive to move with as much speed as the executive desires. I voted for that law during my first term in Congress, and for almost 30 years, the system has proven a valuable and workable means of affording a level of protection for American citizens while permitting foreign surveillance to continue whenever it is necessary. And yet, just 1 month ago, Americans awoke to the shocking news that in spite of this long-settled law, the executive branch has been secretly spying on large numbers of Americans for the last 4 years and eavesdropping on, and I quote the report, large volumes of telephone calls, email messages, and other internet traffic inside the United States. The New York Times reported that the president decided to launch this massive eavesdropping program without search warrants or any new laws that would permit domestic intelligence collection. During the period when this eavesdropping was still secret, the president seemed to go out of his way to reassure the American people on more than one occasion that, of course, judicial permission is required for any government spying on American citizens, and that, of course, these constitutional safeguards were still in place. But surprisingly, the president's soothing statements turned out to be false. Moreover, as soon as this massive domestic spying program was uncovered by the press, the president not only confirmed the story was true, but in the next breath declared that he has no intention of stopping or bringing these wholesale invasions of privacy to an end. At present, we still have much to learn about the NSA's domestic surveillance. What we do know about this pervasive wiretapping virtually compels the conclusion that the President of the United States has been breaking the law repeatedly and insistently. A president who breaks the law is a threat to the very structure of our government. Our founding fathers were adamant that they had established a government of laws and not men. They recognized that the structure of government they had enshrined in our Constitution, our system of checks and balances, was designed with a central purpose of ensuring that it would govern through the rule of law. As John Adams said, the executive shall never exercise the legislative and judicial powers, or either of them, to the end that it may be a government of laws and not of men. An executive who arrogates to himself the power to ignore the legitimate legislative directives of the Congress, or to act free of the check of the judiciary, becomes the central threat that the founders sought to nullify in the Constitution. An all-powerful executive, too reminiscent of the king from whom they had broken free. In the words of James Madison, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. Thomas Paine, whose pamphlet on common sense ignited the American Revolution, succinctly described America's alternative. Here, he said, we intended to make certain that, in his phrase, the law is king. Vigilant adherence to the rule of law actually strengthens our democracy, of course, and strengthens America. It ensures that those who govern us operate within our constitutional structure, which means that our democratic institutions play their indispensable role in shaping policy and determining the direction of our nation. It means that the people of this nation ultimately determine its course and not executive officials operating in secret without constraint under the rule of law. And make no mistake, the rule of law makes us stronger by ensuring that decisions will be tested, studied, reviewed, and examined through the normal processes of government that are designed to improve policy and avoid error. And the knowledge that they will be reviewed prevents overreaching and checks the accretion to power. A commitment to openness, truthfulness, and accountability helps our country avoid many serious mistakes that we would otherwise make. Recently, for example, we learned from just declassified documents after almost 40 years that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized the tragic Vietnam War, was actually based on false information. And we now know that the decision by Congress to authorize the Iraq War 38 years later was also based on false information. Now, the point is that America would have been better off knowing the truth and avoiding both of these colossal mistakes in our history. And that is the reason why following the rule of law makes us safer, not more vulnerable. The President and I agree on one thing. The threat from terrorism is all too real. There is simply no question that we continue to face new challenges in the wake of the attack on September 11th, and we must be ever vigilant in protecting our citizens from harm. Where we disagree is on the proposition that we have to break the law or sacrifice our system of government in order to protect Americans from terrorism, when in fact doing so would make us weaker and more vulnerable. And remember that once violated, the rule of law is itself in danger. Unless stopped, lawlessness grows. The greater the power of the executive grows, the more difficult it becomes for the other branches to perform their constitutional role. As the executive act outside its constitutionally prescribed role and is able to control access to information that would expose its mistakes and reveal errors, it becomes increasingly difficult for the other branches to police its activities. And once that ability is lost, democracy itself is threatened, and we do become a government of men and not laws. The President's men have minced words about America's laws. The Attorney General, for example, openly conceded that the kind of surveillance, in his phrase, that we now know they have been conducting does require a court order unless authorized by statute. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act self-evidently does not authorize what the NSA has been doing, and no one inside or outside the administration claims that it does. Incredibly, the administration claims instead that the surveillance was implicitly authorized when Congress voted to use force against those who attacked us on September 11th. But this argument simply does not hold any water. Without getting into the legal intricacies, it faces a number of embarrassing facts. First, another admission by the Attorney General. He concedes that the administration knew that the NSA project was prohibited by existing law, and that is why they consulted with some members of Congress about the possibility of changing the statute. General Gonzalez says that they were told by the members of Congress consulted that this would probably not be possible, and so they decided not to make the request. So how can they now argue that the authorization for the use of military force somehow implicitly authorized it all along? Indeed, when the authorization was being debated, The administration did, in fact, seek to have language inserted in it that would have authorized them to use military force domestically, and the Congress refused to agree. Senator Ted Stevens and Representative Jim McGovern, among others, made clear statements during the debate on the floor of the House and Senate, respectively, clearly stating that that authorization did not operate domestically, and there is no assertion to the contrary. When President Bush failed to convince Congress to give him the power he wanted when this measure was passed, he secretly assumed that power anyway, as if congressional authorization was a useless bother. But as Justice Frankfurter once wrote, to find authority so explicitly withheld is not merely to disregard in a particular instance the clear will of Congress. It is to disrespect the whole legislative process and the constitutional division of authority between the President and the Congress. This is precisely the disrespect for the law that the Supreme Court struck down in the Steele seizure case during the Korean War. It is this same disrespect for America's Constitution which has now brought our republic to the brink of a dangerous breach in the fabric of the Constitution. And the disrespect embodied in these apparent mass violations of the law is part of a larger pattern of seeming indifference to the Constitution that is deeply troubling to millions of Americans in both political parties. For example, as you know, the President has also declared that he has a heretofore unrecognized inherent power to seize and imprison any American citizen that he alone determines to be a threat to our nation, and that notwithstanding his American citizenship, that person in prison has no right to talk with a lawyer, even if he wants to argue that the President or his appointees have made a mistake and imprisoned the wrong person. The President claims that he can imprison that American citizen, any American citizen he chooses, indefinitely for the rest of his life, without even an arrest warrant, without notifying them of what charges have been filed against them, without even informing their families that they have been imprisoned. No such right exists in the America that you and I know and love. It is foreign to our Constitution. It must be rejected. At the same time, the executive branch has also claimed a previously unrecognized authority to mistreat prisoners in its custody in ways that plainly constitute torture and have plainly constituted torture in a widespread pattern that has been extensively documented in U.S. facilities located in several countries around the world. Over 100 of these captives have reportedly died while being tortured by executive branch interrogators. Many more have been broken and humiliated. And in the notorious Abu Ghraib prison, investigators who documented the pattern of torture estimated that more than 90% of the victims were completely innocent of any criminal charges whatsoever. This is a shameful exercise of power that overturns a set of principles that our nation has observed since General George Washington first enunciated them during our Revolutionary War. They have been observed by every president since then until now. They violate the Geneva Convention, the International Convention Against Torture, and our own laws against torture.
This special edition of the Wild Side News continues when I return.